On this episode of the Endurance Hour podcast, New Year's resolutions, planning for your season in 2016, and our high lows of the year. The Endurance Hour podcast starts right now.
People, are you ready? Let's start the show. Show, let's start the show.
Happy New Year, everybody. Alongside Roger Thompson, I'm Dave Erickson, episode 149er. And I hope you're preparing for a successful year, Roger. We've got snow here in the Inland Northwest, gorgeous, an actual winter wonderland.
Absolutely.
And you've been out in the snow?
I've been out a ton in the snow. I love this. No, actually, I like moving the snow off my driveway, believe it or not. When it's snowing, I can barely sleep. In the morning, I get up at like 4:30 because I just know it's out on my driveway.
No, you don't.
I seriously.
You have a snowblower?
Yeah. Yeah.
And you fire it up at 4:30?
Yeah, I typically, the earliest I think I've ever run it is 5:30.
But do other people, are they running it too?
Well, no. See, what I do, no. Okay. Heavens no. Okay. That's ridiculously early. However, what I do is I do my neighbor's driveways too. That way they can't complain.
Right.
Eh?
Thompson, that
smart,
son of a
I
gun.
Know that.
Nice guy. I guess we're starting the day.
What the heck? Who's starting? Oh, hey, thanks. That's great.
I don't have a snowblower. I just moved to a new house. The gentleman across the street snowblowed my driveway a couple days ago before New Year's Eve, before Christmas Eve.
And it's a tough one because if you do someone's driveway once, and they appreciate it, and they even tell you, you wonder, okay, am I kind of obligated to do
well,
it
Well, I gave
now,
them cookies
the
afterwards.
Yeah, see? And I'll tell you what, and the lady, I get stuff too, but or have, and it's something that I'm like, I'd rather you not even be home while I do. I don't even want acknowledgement at all. I just want to go over and do it and kind of just like, if you know I do it, it's fine. You don't even have to acknowledge it, nothing, zero, or just wave, smile, be a nice neighbor, that's it. But whenever someone gives you something, then you kind of feel like I'm obligated to do it because, hey, remember that gift card I gave you? You remember that?
Yeah.
We got 6 inches today.
Right.
So it's a tough one, but I don't mind doing it. I think the big reason I do it is because it's a single mom that lives across the street and down a little bit, and when we get that a ton of snow, I mean I shoveled our driveway when I was a kid. I mean I was the one that moved the snow, and I know it's a pain and it's a lot of work and it's time, but you know, and I have a big snow blower, and it literally takes me probably to do her whole driveway maybe 2 minutes. So to me it's just like, here, use this time and do something with it.
I thanked him afterwards. I said, you know, you just saved me an hour and a lot of back pain. He goes, I know. But he was nice about it. And so I was like, thank you so much. It saved me so much time. We have family coming over tonight. This is on my list to do. Thanks a bunch. He goes, I know. I got the snowblower. Don't worry about it.
So
it was really cool. But now I feel like I have to get one. But I know what you mean. I used to mow lawns for a living a while ago. And I would go down and mow my buddy's lawn. And it just kind of, maybe it was just the neighborhood felt better.
Right.
You know, everything was in order. Maybe I'm a little that way where I want to have things clean or done, or I like counter space.
Right.
So I'll wipe things down. I like to have things folded. I think things, you know, a certain way.
Right.
And once they are, I feel a bit better.
Right.
So maybe like the same thing. The neighbor across the street, you know, they need it. If I can just do this, I feel, okay, I can move on with the day.
Right.
It's less chaos in the world.
Yeah, that could, I you know, there's a great book that I actually just finished reading called Give and Take. And it talks about people just in general that are givers, takers, and then there's matchers. It's a very interesting book.
Matchers.
But it taught matchers, people that kind of keep tally.
Okay.
It basically said, you did something for me, now
keep
I'll
score.
Do something. Yeah, it's like I don't think they literally keep score in a way, probably we all do mentally. But it's one of those things where there's never true giving without you receiving something. Meaning, it's just impossible to do.
There's no altruistic way, real way of life.
Non-altruistic way. I mean, you say anonymously putting $100 in your neighbor's mailbox. That gives you something. You get something in return for doing that. You don't get their acknowledgement or anything like that, but you get something for doing that by going, I did something great. There's just no way around it. It's an interesting book. I'd be careful to recommend it because there were some really good spots, but it's not a book that I would probably ever read again, but there's some spots I bookmarked that I thought were really cool. But it's an interesting book.
Givers, takers, and matchers?
Give and Take is what it's called.
Oh, it's called Give and Take.
It's called, yeah, just Give and Take.
Here we are talking about it and recommending it almost.
Well, everything's audible, so you know how I am with that. Give and Take, by Adam Grant.
So even when you do give, you are actually receiving.
Yeah.
Without even, even though you meant to give without receiving.
Right. I don't want anything in return. There's no anonymous. It, the only way you could give anonymously is if someone was stealing money from you, like from your, you know, kind of like
yeah.
taking it from your bank account and you didn't know it.
Yeah.
But then are you giving anything? I, you know, there's just no way. And it talked also about how far a good deed goes, like from somebody saying, you know, some lady drops her groceries. And a guy, anybody drops their groceries and you stop and help pick them up in the grocery store. The act of you helping that person obviously helps that person out and they're very appreciative. But people that witness you helping someone, it actually releases, we'll say positive, I guess, what is that called? It's, I want to say, not melatonin.
Serotonin?
Serotonin. thank you. And I think it is. Anyway, and then they, you know, kind of elevate and go, wow, you know, I have a real positive feeling. And then they go and potentially do something for someone else. And so you never really know the ripple effect of a good deed. And so, or not a good deed, but helping others. So anyway.
It's a paying it forward.
In a way.
Because if you do it, let's say at the Starbucks, which if you can go through Starbucks, you can afford it. But if someone says, hey, I'm going to buy the person's
right.
drink behind me.
Right.
You're hoping that person will do the same to the person behind them. You'll feel better when you go to work. Like, oh, that was nice.
Yeah. I feel good. And your attitude from someone buying your Starbucks will rub off on someone else, not because... You know, it's like, hey, someone bought me a Starbucks today. How do you feel now? You know, it's more of like you feel better. You treat someone better. They feel better. They, you know, it just eventually ripples out. It's an interesting, you know, probably people are hearing this and going, yeah, duh, that's called this, you know, whatever. It was cool. It was good. But I don't know where we got into that. But talking about snow blowing driveways.
Oh, yeah, right. There you go.
Giving.
And so. It's the first of the year, wherever you live, maybe you are in a tropical area and you don't have to worry about blowing someone's driveway off of snow. Maybe they've got a sandy driveway.
Right. Maybe it's a hill. Yeah. Go sweep it.
Go sweep their hill. Hey, New Year's. I found some interesting stats, Roger, about New Year's resolutions. And we're going to talk about that today with the triathlete lifestyle and planning for the year. But these were the top 10 New Year's resolutions for 2015. Number one, you can probably guess what it is.
Lose weight.
Losing weight. Number two,
workout.
Well,
routine.
Close.
Fit.
Not even close. Getting organized.
Oh.
Number three, spend less, save more. So financially. Enjoying life to the fullest. Number four, here is number five, staying fit and healthy. So staying fit, not getting fit, but staying fit. Learn something exciting, quit smoking, helping others in their dreams, fall in love, spend more time with family was number 10. So people would rather lose weight than spend more time with their family.
Well, that makes sense.
In the top 10 list for last year. Now, this is much like people who get a gym membership. You know, how long do you stick with it? So what's the success rate? So length of resolutions. People who maintain through the first week of the people who make them. 75%.
Wait. Say that again.
Length of resolutions. Resolutions maintained through the first week of January.
Okay, so 25% bail. First week.
25.
Okay.
In 7 days.
Right.
Past 2 weeks, 71%. So a very small drop off. 64% stick with it after a month. That's how many people are left. And 6 months later, 46%. That's pretty impressive. Almost half the people
make
resolutions.
Are we taking the whole, though? I mean, when you say, here's my math mind working.
Okay.
So let's say we have 100 people.
Yeah.
After the first week, we lose 75. Only 75 are left. So you lose 25%.
Right.
And then it says the next week, you're at 71. Is it still taking, are we still working from that 100?
Yes.
Or are we taking 71% of the 75%?
This is how many have maintained.
Okay, total.
Through the first month, 64% have maintained.
I got you.
Through 1 month. And 46% have maintained through the first half of the year.
Wow, so half, it's
that's pretty good.
Half and half. Well, below half, but.
So doesn't it, don't they say it takes like 3 months to, I thought 3 months to create a habit.
21 days.
21 days? 3 weeks? I think there's a 3 in there somewhere.
Yeah, maybe it is.
21 days to create a habit?
I thought it was 21 days
to
create a habit. I don't think that's totally accurate because I can easily do something for 21 days, and if I don't like it, I can stop doing it pretty quickly.
If you don't like it.
Yeah.
Well, it depends on what you like and what you don't like. So you said to something to me maybe a month ago, if you dedicate, let's say you're looking at that Iron Man video or that poster on the wall, you've signed up for a race, or you're thinking about signing up for a race, before you do, work out 10 hard straight days. Or what was that? Wait 10 days to see if you're still as enthusiastic.
There's two things, and I think this is really specific towards triathlon or Ironman in particular, is that, you know, people see an Ironman, they watch it, maybe are at a finish line and go, I really want to do that. Or maybe they've done Olympic distances and even halves and say, I really want to do an Ironman. And it's just like, it's easy to say, you know, when you're emotionally excited and going, yes, I will do that. It's just like, but I think, and this comes from nothing other than just me saying it, is saying, how about this? Go 2 weeks and do a normal Ironman training block. Just do a normal Ironman, commit that amount of time for 2 weeks. And if at the end of that 2 weeks, you're still passionate about it, then sign up. The other piece is if
you... Now, how far out are you talking about? If it's 4 months away?
Well, no. Just like, let's say you're at a... Let's say Ironman Coeur d'Alene. Okay. You show up down there, whatever date is it, last year, June 20-something. And you show up and you're like, I want to do this. You know, this is so cool. And I'm going to sign up tomorrow. And a lot of these Ironmans, you kind of have to.
Yeah.
But it's just like, before you do that, it takes more than watching a finish line to get across that finish line. Mm-hmm. It takes an entire year, a lot of sacrifices, a lot of dedication, a lot of mental strength to just make it. And that's what I just say, just train for 2 weeks at an Ironman block, you know, whether that's, you know, 15 hours or whatever it is, the longer rides, just do it for 2 weeks. And if after 2 weeks you're like, man, I love this, then sign up, you know. But it's, I think sometimes we get caught into that, you know, emotional piece and forgetting, even after we've trained for an Ironman and we finish it and we want to do 10 more that day, you know, in terms of signing up for them. Mm-hmm. But we forget the time and commitment and the sacrifice that was made to get to that finish line for that race. So that to me is just in general, you know, when people haven't done one or it's their first whatever, or they're thinking about it, is just like, just see if you're in it for the training. Because if you're complaining right now about training 5 hours a week or 3 hours a week, signing up for an Ironman isn't going to just all of a sudden motivate you to train, you know, 12 and 13 hours a week. Mm-hmm. So that, and the other piece I think you're referencing is, I'm always really careful about when people sign up for races. It's like, we are all really excited and motivated at midnight. We'll sign up for everything late at night. Mm-hmm. Get up early in the morning at 6:30 in the morning and sign up and see if you're the same motivation is there. Their optimism is there.
I'd say sign up even time. Wake up even earlier, because that's when you would be waking up to do your workouts.
They get up at 3:30 and say, does this feel like a good idea right now?
Yeah.
But anyway, those are just little kind of mental there's no science behind that, I don't think. It's just me saying, you know, Ironman isn't just a finish line. There's a lot that goes into it. And then, of course, you go into the family commitment and you go into making sure everyone's on board, all that stuff. But I'm just saying, mentally, man, you know, it's taxing. You get a month out and you're like going, if I could get out of this, I would. You know,
I'll reveal something from last year is the whole Ironman Coeur d'Alene for me. And then I signed up. Well, actually, I was signed up for two races. And the thing was, and I'll tell you, both races were comped. There was a trade. I was doing a trade.
Right. So well, it wasn't comped.
I wasn't paying out of my pocket. I was paying with work exchanged.
Right.
Anyways, I didn't pay out of the pocket. So the whole I didn't have skin in the game mentality or investment didn't feel like I did because I didn't have to pay write that big check.
Right.
So Coeur d'Alene came late as a trade. So I did it, but my heart wasn't into it. And then Ironman Arizona, still months and months away. But at that point, I was out. Mentally, I was out. So making that commitment financially, or looking at your yearly block and saying, okay, oh, that looks good right there. I can do that at, you know, month five, and I can do that at month seven or month eight. That looks good. I can do that full year. But the tax on you mentally throughout the full year, it's hard. It's just hard to stick with it and break it up mentally. So with this whole theme of New Year's resolutions and planning for the year, let's kind of be realistic on what can the athlete's mind handle for 12 months, or we break it down in less. What's a realistic way to handle a lead up to a race? A 4 month block? Is that more manageable versus, oh God, it's 7 months away, or that's I'm planning an Ironman at 6 months and at 10 months. That's a long, long year.
I think there's about, I don't know, five variables that go into what you're saying there. And this is me just thinking. Dave's throwing these questions at me. I haven't even thought about them. But as I can think of, for in general, is I think people struggle. Like, let's say for in your situation, Ironman Arizona.
Mm-hmm. Which I ended up dropping out.
Which, yeah, you didn't do.
I pulled out and I said, hey, give the entry to somebody else.
Okay.
I'm not going to do the work. It was nice. I mean, right. Okay, I won't worry about doing what I was going to do. And if you give it to somebody else, that'd be great. It's an even swap.
So you had Arizona way down the road in November, what, 21st or something like that?
Something.
Late November. And then, but you were, you know, when you sign up for a race that far out, we're talking, you know, so far down the road and you're finishing up a season. It's, you know, maybe it's, you know, January and you're like, oh, I've got my big race is Arizona. Mm-hmm. And that's 11 months away. Yeah. It's like almost a year away. But you're training for it. In your mind, that's what you're getting ready for. I think that's the kind of the rub that people have is as you're seeing everybody else right now going, oh, my New Year's resolutions, and I'm out there training right now. I'm putting in these long yards in the pool, and I'm running, and you see all these people doing that, and you're like, oh, I guess I need to do that too. But your race is almost a year away. A lot of these people are preparing for a race that's 6 months away or mm-hmm. 5 months away. So I think that's number one is when you're preparing your schedule is looking at where the race is and then working backwards from it and saying, okay, what? And for me, I know for me, I can do that and know what my mind can handle and my body can handle and training load. If you sign up for a race that's a year and a half away, let's say, does that mean you'd start training for a year and a half out for that race? You know, no, you need to have a break in there. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one thing about as an athlete that's raced a lot and trained a lot is saying how does my body respond mentally? Even more importantly, how am I after the first 3 months or 2 months or as I hit 6 months? What happens? 7 months? 8 months? What's going on in my mind? And using that as like, wow, I remember this really sucked. This is really hard. So I think to answer your question, you have so many variables there. I think when your race is. And then looking at what you need to do to prepare, where your baseline fitness is right now. If your season finished, like let's say in maybe you did your last race in the beginning of August, and then since then you've been kind of just dinking around, doing yard work, playing some basketball here and there, and your next race you have a big race in say June. You know, where's your fitness right now since you haven't done a race or did any formal triathlon training since August? Mm-hmm. Where are you right now? So there's a lot of things. Where are you? What race are you preparing for? What is your cycle mentally and physically? What is your workload? Where are vacations? Where are, you know, all those things. That's why I have a hard time with, you know, like, I think schedules, like formatted schedules, like you can buy online and stuff, you know, like, oh, here's a 6 month Ironman training plan, which I think is great. Mm-hmm. It's something to work from, but we can't just kind of drop it into a schedule because there's so many variables mm-hmm. in each one of us that's different. We have different needs. We have different time allotments. You know, an athlete that I work with travels a ridiculous amount, and it's one of the hardest things to work around because, you know, when he's home, it's like, that's when I can get my long rides in. But it's like, as you know, when you have a family and you have been traveling, mm-hmm. being gone from your family for 6 hours on a ride because you had to drive somewhere and go ride, and then, you know, that's going to beat you up as well. So, I think I just muddied the water more than anything.
Well, in previous episodes, I know talking with Wendy Mader out of mm-hmm. Fort Collins, Colorado, or she's moved to Atlanta. Yeah. I think she said that you need to, the most important weeks leading up to a race might be 8 weeks or right. something. You have a certain,
right.
you can't really mess with. So is the athlete really need to be prepared to dedicate, can they handle, or what's the minimum requirement if you're going to be steady through something? Is it 16 weeks? Is it 10 weeks? Is it 12 weeks? What should you tell someone? You need to be dedicated at least 8 straight weeks before your race. That's what you need to be most focused on because those are critical weeks. Like you're saying, if you're 6 months out, those first few months getting into it, yeah, those
right.
that workout's not going to be super critical to your performance as much as the maybe those 8 weeks prior. Because if you miss that core ride or key ride, yeah, you're not going to get what you need.
Well, let me be more vague, and I agree with Wendy. I mean, we can break it down like that, but let's say, you know, ideally, and again, I'm just going to use nice round numbers, you need to train 10 hours a week, you know, and that's what's important. You know, this is what you need to do. 8 weeks out, you need to train 10 hours a week doing this. By the way, that's a little lean, but mm-hmm. But you don't have 10 hours. You have six.
Mm.
Yeah, but you need to train 10. I have six. It doesn't matter what ideal is if ideal doesn't work in your life. So I guess that's what I'm saying for the normal person. Mm-hmm. And we all know a lot of normal people. I think that's the number one thing is with your New Year's resolution, and I think it's across the board, is whatever you choose to bite off, make sure it's reasonable. Make sure it's something that you can do. And that's why you see such a drop in New Year's resolutions is like, oh, I wanted to work out every single day starting January 1st. And after 6 days, I missed a day because I got sick. Well, screw it. I guess I'll have to wait till next year to start working out again. It's like, no, that's just a goal. That's a dream. And you know what? You can start over or pick up where you left off. And that it's, we create New Year's resolutions to hopefully create a positive pattern in our life. It doesn't mean we're so black and white. We're so, you know, just, it's got to be, you know, this or that. It's life. We can't be, you know, maybe you do work out. I know there's some people that have run, I forget how long, like 700 days in a row, you know, and they ran when they were sick and they ran. It's just like, well, good for you. I mean, that's awesome, but what does it really mean? So I guess going back to your question, yeah, 8 weeks out is you know, it's 2 months, essentially. You have a week and a half, 2 weeks of a taper in there, and you have a big, huge last, you know.
From all the athletes you've coached or come in contact with who have been fairly dedicated to this sport, what do you find is the general amount of weeks that they can stay focused? Is there a kind of a generalized, most people can handle 12 straight weeks of working out before they either fade, they lose their interest, they get injured. Is there a framework? I'm trying to look at a scale.
Absolutely.
Here, how you can get it closer and closer.
But that's how it works, though. You get 100. There's some people I've worked with for, I don't know how many. I mean, I shouldn't say I don't know how many. I could tell you. But like 5 years.
Uh-huh.
And they're like clockwork. I get an email from them after, I mean, this time, almost every month, not this month, but that says, oh, I question what I'm doing. I'm not sure right now. I feel real, you know, I'm not sure if I'm doing enough. And I can forward them an email, two emails that I received almost within the same week, you know, of just how they're feeling mentally.
From previous
lead years.
Lead up or something?
Yeah. So in terms of, we all go through cycles. I go through the same cycle. And that's what I think having, whether it's a coach, whether it's someone you work out with, whether it's, you know, just your support system, be able to bounce things off of, and they can say, you always say this before a race. You always say this at this time. When you're tired, this is how you feel, you know, after a big, huge, large bike block. You just wonder, you know, you feel wrecked and you're wondering why you do this. Just give it a day, take a day off, you know, recharge the batteries, go eat some ice cream and see where you are tomorrow, you know, before you quit your day job. You know, why don't you wait till tomorrow?
Is it like being a school teacher? You see the same group, you see the same age group come through over the years and go, these are the general things they talk about because that's what the age group talks about.
100%.
This is their phrase.
It's a great analogy. It's a great analogy. Oh, here's where they think they're dumb. Here's where they think they know what's going on and they're really overconfident. And now they're going to get this test back and they're going to be devastated. I'm going to get about 12 emails from parents and I'll just send them the same email back and then they'll be fine. You know?
Yeah.
It's cyclical and we're all, you know, I wish there was a silver bullet. There isn't. It's just, as I say over and over, ironically here, consistency, man, it's just consistency. You know, if you have an hour run to do and you can only get in 35 minutes, get in the 35 minutes, you know, don't just go, well, I can't get in the hour. So I guess I'm screwed. My whole season's ruined.
So there's a danger of starting too early. Starting your lead up way too early because of the potential burnout.
100%.
Starting too late? Can you not make it up, but because we have that 8 week key window, as long as you allow yourself that, let's use 8 weeks for example. As long as you leave yourself 8 weeks, instead of starting at 16, let's say you started at 9. Okay, at least I still had that 8 week window. I'm okay with the lead up, you know, trying to peak.
Right.
Because we're trying to peak at the right time. You start too early, you're not going to peak the right time. You start too late, obviously, you won't get to peak the right time.
Well, yes and no. That 8 week that Wendy's referring to is kind of predicated on a on a foundation that came prior to that. So you can't just say, well, I'm not going to do anything until that 8 weeks, and then I'm going to really get after it. It's like, well, no, you can't really do that either.
Yeah.
But I think, I mean, going back to what we were talking about before, you have to know how your body works and mentally what you can... What I see happen probably more than anything is people start off the year far too, you know, gung-ho. I mean, it's like, I'm going to sit on the trainer in the basement for 5 hours a day. And it's just like, you are burning so many mental matches when you do that. You know, save those for later. Right now, you know, it's about getting out, being consistent, having fun.
Turning and, the legs.
Yeah, get, you know, if you haven't been doing anything, just making sure you don't have those injuries, taking care of things, getting the mechanics, the drills, everything down. So as the increase of volume and intensity comes, you can, you know, adapt to that.
Can you, and I'm going to cross this over to all three disciplines, can you swim too much? Can you, I mean, swim too often, not too much. Swim too often, bike too often, and run too often early in the season. Even if it's like, for example, a half hour in this pool every day.
Right.
A bike, on the bike, 1 hour a day every day. Run 30 minutes every day, but it's only 30 minutes.
Right.
Is that okay versus...
I mean, I think it's physically possible.
That's not burnout, is it? It's well, you're staying active, but nothing, it's not focused.
Well, burnout is referring more to your mind is a lot more versus, you know, overreaching and being completely physically, you know, your body's just plateaued and now it's dropping. You're just, you're coming apart. Your performance is dropping. So I think that's, you know, and going into, you know, recovery is your body's ability to adapt to the workload. That's what you do. And if you go and swim and the next day you can get in the pool and you still feel sharp and you can swim again, great. And you can swim again, great. But maybe it's better to break that up and not swim as much. But I mean, my daughter, she swims just about every single day. And I mean, and somehow she survives and she's swimming an hour and a half every day, and then sometimes does some other things. So I think it just depends on. I think you can't. I mean, it's just like I'm going to take a swimmer's, you know, schedule, and I'm going to take my buddy who's a cyclist schedule, and I'm going to take a running schedule. I'm going to do all of it every single day. Does that make you better, or does that just make you pretty average at everything? And I think ultimately you have to have those highs and lows, not just flat.
But that's,
and I think when you do that, I think when you're doing one of those things every single day with the same intensity, which is what it sounds like.
Yeah.
I don't, you could try it. I don't think there's
some consistency involved in that.
Absolutely.
And if you're just, before you getting focused,
right.
Is there any danger to that?
No, I don't. I mean, if it's just, you know, running through the motions, no, it's like active recovery or even just, you know, a zone two effort, you know, just like getting out there and doing it. No, as long as I think there's a lot of, you know, for most people, if you're to say, okay, I'm going to have you swim, bike, and run every single day for the next, you know, 60 days. I think that would be overwhelming to somebody. They're just like, holy cow. Okay, now I got to go run. Now I got to go run, you know, and I think I don't think there's any schedule out there. Now there's a lot of them that do two a day, you know, you'd have a run and maybe have a swim and maybe a bike and, you know, a certain type of, you know, swim as well. And then you just have a run. But I think it's about allowing your body to recover. If you're always allowing your body to recover, you know, and you're not stressing it.
If you're not working too hard, then
yeah, and you're having fun and stuff like that, yeah. But if it's all a hammer session and you're racing the person in the pool next to you and your cool song comes on and you bury yourself on the, you know, the bike and you know, I don't know if you're just out there going through the motions.
You hear about, we've talked to other professionals, and this is probably a more of a professional line of talk, is I remember talking to Lindsay Corbin when she was in Arizona, like in Tucson,
right,
leading up to her season, and she just already come back from her swim workout that morning. Then she talked to us. So it's like, that's something she does every single day.
Right.
You can get away with swimming every day because it's the least taxing on your joints and your body. And then they go, they rest, they eat their breakfast, they recover, and then they get a massage, they take a nap, then they go out and do their workout.
Right.
So there shouldn't be anything wrong with swimming every day.
Remember, that's their profession. I know it's a little different. They're coming from a background of a professional athlete. Mm-hmm. Big difference when that's all you, I mean, I don't say all you do, but that's a big part of their, I mean, and I think your legit professional athletes are extremely organized as well. It's not just they stay at home and they do two workouts a day type thing. I think they have sponsor requirements. They have articles to write, you know, websites to update, you know,
If they update their websites.
Yeah, if they do. I don't think anyone does that anymore. Websites, it's just Facebook. But you're comparing apples and oranges. Going back to your original question, though, of saying...
consistency creating, of doing something every day, even if it's a small amount, there's nothing wrong with that, is
there? Well, I get, you know, massage or physical therapy or anything like that. I consider that training. I lock that in as training. I mean, and people just think that training is, I got to go out and my heart rate has to be a certain level and I got to be miserable and I got to get back and feel like crap and need to take a nap. That's training. It's like, not really. There's actually more that can be done at some points of doing absolutely zero or nothing, or essentially sleeping. You could gain more potentially from sleeping an extra hour a day than going and training.
I thought about that this morning. Actually, it's funny you mentioned that. I wanted to get up early just to go a bike before you got here, but I didn't sleep very well last night. I couldn't fall asleep for over an hour, and then I woke up, let the dog out, and then I laid back in bed. And next thing you know, I'm waking up at, you know, after the fact, and it's like, oh my gosh, it's probably more important that I continue resting, because if I get on the bike and work out somewhat hard on a fatigued body, it's not going to be worth it.
Yeah, I know our buddy Ben, he uses heart rate variability, his little I forget what he uses, but it tracks your recovery and your ability to adapt to a large load of work or high intensity, or if you know you're just fatigued. You're just fatigued right now. This might be on your calendar to go do this crazy workout, but just to let you know, your body is beat up right now. So you can go do it, but you might have some consequences that now you're going to have to take 3 days off, you know. So, but yeah, again, we've talked about this before. It's just about the more you train, the more you race, the more you're involved in the cycle, the more you learn about your body. And it's so much more than just a training schedule. It's about... knowing, I mean, Brett Sutton talks about that. I just need to talk to him on the phone. An email doesn't do it. I can hear it in their voice where they are. You mean, it's like they can tell me, oh, I'm feeling great. Yeah, no, you're not. You need to take next week. You know, we're going to switch things around because we're all different. You know, your stresses that you have, you just moved into a house and tons of projects here. And now think if you were in a, you know, huge Ironman build block. Oh, and by the way, you need to get 6 hours in today and tomorrow. You know, you have this and this, and in your mind, you go, I just got to get that paint done. I got to get.
I was beat. I was wrecked for that week or so of moving things over here, and my joints were swollen.
Oh, absolutely.
I was starting to get sick. It's like there's no, that would have been stupid to try to do anything exercise related.
So that's my point, is like everybody, we're all different in our life, being normal people with other careers and things and responsibilities, real life. You can't just say, this is what you need to do. So going back to that, you know, how much time do you need to put in? It's like, well, you know, in a perfect cookie cutter, this is typically the build phase. You need to be able to put in this amount of time. Okay, I can only put in this amount of time. Do you just scrap it? No, but you probably should adjust your goals, you know, and that's, I think, the big, huge, you know, the sun in it all of saying, you know, like people ask me, it's like, oh, I want to run a marathon. You could right now go run a marathon. Oh, no, no. I'm like, you couldn't possibly go 26.2 miles. Well, yeah, I could, but... I would want, okay, there's your, the variable there is like, you want to be able to do it in a certain amount of time. So.
Slide the scale back.
Oh,
expectations, man, and time investment.
Yeah, yeah. And people come in saying, I'm going to commit 100%. It's like, no, you're not. No one does. No one does.
Build up
nobody
to 100%.
Nobody does.
Yeah.
So what percentage of, how valuable is this to you? And what's your goal? And is it reasonable? And does your training support your goal? Does your lifestyle in terms of your other obligations match up with what your goal is and what the training, the realistic training time is? I mean, I don't know how many people say they can train a certain amount of time and all of a sudden it's like, you know, they're skipping workouts. It's like, I know you said you could train this much, but my guess is it's really this much. And that's what you want to be, is successful, rather versus getting to the end of a week and saying, crap, I missed 3 workouts this week. Crap, you know, and that's all you focus on is the negativity versus going, I nailed everything. I nailed everything. I got everything. And how much that motivates you to go week to week.
We're about to wrap this up.
Yeah, sorry. We got long on that one.
We're making these episodes shorter in 2016. Two things we're going to finish off with. First of all, do you have any New Year's resolutions? Do you make them?
Do I make them? No, I make them all throughout the year.
Okay.
When I see I need to make changes, I draw a line in the sand and
why,
go.
Why wait, right?
Why wait? My wife, on the other hand, has like spreadsheets. No, I kid you not, only because I just saw them yesterday. She was going through them. But that's how she holds herself accountable. On her phone, she looks, or on her computer, she looks at things that she wants to do every single month, from family to personal stuff to finances to work-related to, you know, just every... It's unbelievable.
But that's not a New Year's resolution, is it? That's just a way of life for her.
No, that's her New Year's resolution. Oh, okay. She sits down, takes a day, and comes up and reflects back on the entire year and looks at things of value. And it changes. You know, it changes every... year, and there's things to celebrate and things that, you know, she doesn't consider it a failure. It's like, I really wanted to say, have my sister over, you know, once a month, or take her dinner once, whatever it might be. I'm just throwing that out there. And maybe she did it 11 months out of the 12, or maybe 8 months out of the 12. It's still something to celebrate. It's like, you know what? It was on my mind. It was on my radar. And if I have it written down, I'll do it, versus saying, you know, starting the year, yeah, it'd be cool if, and then you go on back into your old patterns.
So why not you? Why not you make resolutions? Why don't you?
I probably do, but I don't call them New Year's resolutions. I just call them, you know, kind of goals, things I want to do.
Did you at one time? Or did you at one point think, wow, Mike, this is so silly for me, for you?
Well, I think that's a human behavior. We can justify everything we do. You know, you can say, I'm not going to eat any processed food. Let's just say that's one of them. By the way, it's not one of mine. I'm not gonna drink any pop. We'll say that. No pop. And then all of a sudden, you know, you're 3 weeks in and you're at a pizza joint and you're up cross country skiing all day and you're tired and everything, and pizza's out, and there's a, you know, someone gives you a soda, and you're like, oh no, I'll drink that soda. And you know, now it's like, is everything, oh well, you know, I'm a failure. You know, no, it's like, well, but we do work a lot better with yeses and nos, you know, like whether it's alcohol.
Absolutes.
Yeah, absolutes. And you know, that's just human behavior. We thrive on that. It's easier to keep track of things, you know. No alcohol, ever. Well, except now.
I don't think I keep them either. I don't know when I stop. It just didn't seem like... I like to make goals all the time or have a to-do list. It's like I kind of plan 1 week at a time, or maybe I'll do a month at a time. Right. I'm not a resolutions kind of guy. The next thing, the last thing, as we wrap up 149, is what are your season goals in terms of resolutions? What are your... actually, there's two more things. I got one more idea.
No.
What are your resolutions for this year in terms of triathlon? What are your... Not resolutions, but your goals for the season?
Wow, I got to throw that out there. You know, it's crazy because I'm actually literally mapping this stuff out, which goes into... I have this awesome calendar that I wanted... that Jesse actually got me for Christmas. It's a calendar. I don't know if I told you about this.
A physical calendar?
Yeah, it's a physical calendar that I could literally put on the wall, because I like to be able to see everything, like some stuff that I've shown you that I like to see at all. But when I'm planning, I don't like looking at 7 days. I think when we train, we look, oh, Sunday is my long run day. Saturday is my long ride. I mean, and I know I fall into that too, because that's how our life is kind of set up, is on a 7 day a week deal.
Yeah.
But really, if our bodies work in, say, 10 to 13 day cycles, 10 days is really more ideal than seven for building things. So I like to look at kind of a calendar, then I can work out and slot, okay, here's where I'd like to do these things, and there's a race here and race, and I can just kind of look at the big picture. Even on a computer, it's too hard for me. It's too small. Yeah. I like something big. It's like, I don't know how big this thing is. It's probably like 2 yards wide and a yard and a half tall, but each month. So I'm in the process of doing that. So what's my goal this year? I want to race Whistler. That's a big one. I mean, that's probably the one. I'll probably do Troika. And so I'm giving you my race schedule. Now, what are my goals? Hard to say. I'd like to end up in Kona again. But again, that's, I know there's so many things that can happen between now and then. I think I'll have a better idea, a better sense as I'm going into that. I think I'm going to change my training a little bit this year, kind of roll the dice on a couple other things. But
are you down for the mountain bike race again?
I think so. I don't know. I mean, I haven't really heard too much about that. I'd like to. Yeah. I think it's fun. It's great training. It's great stress on the body. I think so. It'd be kind of fun.
Yeah.
I like it. But in terms of schedule, what are my goals? You know, it's probably, I'd love to do the the race here, the 70.3 in Coeur d'Alene that's taking the place, but I don't think I will just because it's too close to Whistler. And but yeah, that's, you know, nothing crazy. Okay. Those are my kind of the big ones.
Okay.
So, but I know Jessie, she has her business, and you know, we juggle a lot with that, and it's awesome. It's great things that are going on with that and stories that she brings home. And yep, it's a huge role in what we're doing too. So got to make sure that we keep perspective on things. So
in a high low type of finale here,
right?
High low of 2015.
Whoa.
Triathlon related.
Oh, yeah. Triathlon related. Yeah. High low. If I reflect back on the year, I would have to say the high would be Coeur d'Alene. Not because of winning my age group. That's not it. It's just that, I mean, surviving that day and getting across that line and dealing with, I hate the heat. Mm-hmm. You know, I say, you're not supposed to say that. You're just, you know, no, I do. I really hate the heat. I know it's a challenge, but, and then getting a flat in the race and feeling like crap as everybody did, I know, but of course we all think we felt worse than everybody else on that run, you know, and overheating on the bike and slowing down, you know, just all those things and just having the, I guess the mental tenacity just to continue moving forward and trying to make adjustments and I guess staying engaged in the day. And I think anybody that crossed that finish line or even, you know, was out there getting from point A to point B and maybe not even getting to the finish line, they probably can all relate to what that was like on that day. So, yeah, I mean, yeah, that was probably the high point. I think only because it was so difficult.
Because of what you accomplished on the day, not the results, but how you
I mean, the result obviously was great, but I mean, it's just like, yeah, but that's results are results.
To get there. It's how you got there that matters.
That to me, especially in Coeur d'Alene, you know, it's always been a hurdle. So yeah, that, I think that was the highlight in terms of performance. I mean, Kona's Kona. I mean, that's a pretty easy one to say, oh, it's really great, you know, to be there overcoming that. But Coeur d'Alene is one that was just changing as the day got closer and closer.
Yeah, yeah.
How about you, highs? Your high for the season?
Well, and I'm listening to you, and I'm hearing, because I was I experienced Coeur d'Alene as well, and I'm not sure that, I wanted to say it's a low, but I discovered a lot about myself on the day, and the whole being stubborn or not being a quitter. I know I should have quit a race in which I, in the Titanium Man a few years ago when I got hit, I should have never continued that race.
Right.
That was a mistake. But there's some, you know, something stubborn in me that says I'm going to finish this race because I physically can. It was a mistake because I ran in my shoes for a few miles, and I ran without shoes for a while, and that was a stupid move. So it wasn't worth it. It was dumb. But I wanted to, the pride of, I want to finish this race.
Absolutely.
Even after that experience. So it was kind of a high that I stuck through it, but it was a low because I wasn't in it. Mentally, my heart wasn't in that race. So in a way that was kind of a low, but my high, I want to finish on a high note. High was the Troika a few weeks earlier, a month earlier of, probably my most consistent lead up to a race that I've ever done.
Uh-huh.
And I had a good race. And so that felt good.
That wasn't an easy day either. It was a warm one.
In a way there was one low on that race and I wish it was losing to one of our friends by 30 seconds for the first in the age group. That was a little bummer, but I don't know how much more I would have done different on the day to get that point. It just happened.
Right.
No, I still felt great about it. It was a PR, so that was my high, I think, of the day, of the year. But the low was just losing passion for the
boy, year. I'll tell you what, to finish, well, obviously you finished Titanium Man after getting hit by a car, but in an Ironman, to be in that hole, that dark spot of just going, you know, and I know you even had people say, you don't have to do this. You can stop now. Mm-hmm. We could still get a good seat at the dockside. Mm-hmm. No, you know, I think that, I mean, that's, we all have that on our own shoulders of things saying, you know, it'd be a lot easier if you just stopped right now. You know, I could stop right now. It's no big deal. Who's in control here? I'm in control. I don't want to do this anymore.
A lot
I'm
of making self-talk. This.
And to, you know, and then all you need is someone else, you know, someone that's your family or friends or whatever that says, you know, if it, you know, don't do anything stupid, you know, be careful. You don't want to do any long-term damage. It's like all those little low-hanging fruit options. You know, it's like, okay, I'm going to stop. But to not, I mean, I think that's,
Well, there's a point of no return too. I think if you're at a, in a distance like that and you've gone so far, it's like, I've made it this far. I can just kind of fight through this. I can. I'm going to walk it, which I did. I can just walk the rest of this thing.
Yeah, I think you're underselling that. I think a lot of people go, no, I think I'm done. I don't care. And honestly start selling themselves. And especially for you that had planned on doing Ironman Arizona, going, yeah, this wasn't even on my radar. You know, Arizona. I mean, the things that you could have sold yourself on to drop out of that race, I mean, trumps probably what anybody else could have.
There's probably some ego involved.
Yeah, absolutely.
Of knowing people are out there waiting for me, or right. whether it was my wife there, seeing Jesse and Emma at one corner giving ice, saw Steve Anderson,
right.
Saw Greg and Natalie. So I saw a few people out there like, I need to keep going.
Right.
I need to prove that I'm worth my weight in salt.
Right.
And I want to show that I'm tough.
Or you didn't have much salt left at that point.
I had no salt. I was losing everything. I wanted to prove that I could right. do it. And so that was kind of like, all right, I'm not going to quit this. If I can do this, then I can stand up and say, hey, you can do it. Almost.
Right.
You know.
Well, I finished, I mean, like you said, you finished this race on the worst day of this course history. Yeah. I mean, in terms of, I mean, the first year was horrible. I raced that year too. It was like the hottest day in history of there. And then of course, then, you know, then this one. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, yeah, people were literally just pulling themselves off the course going, I might die. So
I did it for me.
All right. And again, like I said, I think that's pretty awesome.
This wraps up episode 149. Happy New Year. And coming up next episode, a great topic about recovery. Roger and I are going to talk about sleep, compression, even cold water immersion on some of the benefits, pros and cons of this, because you're going to need it if you're planning to do some hard races this year. And, you know, maybe just to maintain your body through the season, depends on how long you want to make it. So that's going to be coming up on episode 150 of the podcast. So with that, Roger, we'll wrap it up again. Thanks for listening. Thanks for following us on Facebook. And we'll see you next time. Have a great week of training, racing, or recovering.
All right.
Adios. Don't let me hear you say life's taking you nowhere. Angel. Look at that sky. Life's begun. Nights are warm and the days are young.